From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Woody Carter, author of a fascinating new novel, Narada's Children, A Visionary Tale of Two Cities. In addition to being a writer, Woody Carter is a narrative theologian and public speaker. Previously, he served as an associate professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco and as an instructor in theater arts at several community colleges in the Bay Area. He is also a retired executive director of the Bay Area Black United Fund. That's an identity-based philanthropy in Oakland, California. Carter's novel, Narada's Children, A Visionary Tale of Two Cities, is a spiritual tale of two cities that brings together mystical elements from different religious traditions to connect far-flung communities with a common African heritage. The story begins in a desert expanse in the Horn of Africa during the late 19th century. The protagonist, Narada, is wandering without provisions under a curse that's the result of his own act of deception. A young woman invites him to her father's home in the old walled city of Jausu. She eventually becomes one of Narada's, quote, children, along with other characters who receive spiritual guidance from Narada through the magic of storytelling. Each evening for 7 days, Narada takes his audience on a magical journey to Oakland, California, in 2003, where Arthur Renfro works to improve the health of the African-American community while struggling with spiritual possession and a broken marriage. Prior to this novel, Carter wrote Theology for a Violent Age, Religious Beliefs Crippling African-American Youth. And Woody Carter joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm very impressed by your introduction. I'd like to meet that person.
He's right here with us. So let's talk about yourself, Woody. But first, you know, what prompted you to write this particular novel? And to what extent would you say is it autobiographical?
Well, you know, working full-time as a professional fundraiser, and that's actually what I did when I worked in the Bay Area Black United Fund, I always wanted to write a novel, but put it off because I had so much to do, little time to do it, and that was my excuse. And secondly, it just seemed like a overwhelming task. But once I retired, I realized, you know, you meet people when they get older, they start talking to people on the street they don't really know, and you can't shut them up, and you're trying to figure out a polite way to get away. I begin to understand why people, as they go older, especially if they're by themselves, get like that. And I said, well, I don't want to end up like that. I need to write.
Well, it's a work of fiction, but there are place names and ethnicities that we associate with the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia in particular. Why did you choose to locate events in this part of the world?
Well, you know, in writing a novel, especially the first novel, it was very important to relate to your own personal experience. And my experience was I lived 2 years in Harar, Ethiopia, on the Horn of Africa. So I had a sense of the culture, and I lived in a city called Harare, which had actually 12 gates to the city. It was an old city, Muslim city. I lived there for 2 years. As a matter of fact, the only foreigner that ever lived in that city, except for Rimbaud the poet, who lived there in the late 1800s. And then my experience working in Oakland, California, with the Bay Area Black United Fund, I worked in the African-American community. And somehow I needed to bring those two different worlds together because that has been my formative experience. I felt like I needed to bring those two worldviews together, so to speak. And that's how Narada's Children was born.
Let's talk more about the setting, the location. It seems to be an amalgam of East African and Middle Eastern cultures. And the religion that we hear about is also reminiscent of Islam and perhaps other mystical influences like Hinduism. Is that correct?
That's correct. I would think that's true. You know, many notable world teachers, especially in those religious disciplines that have a mystical element, like the Sufis, the Hindus, Muslims, they always point to the fact that at some place, it's like each religion is part of a wheel. Each one religion is a spoke. And all the spokes lead to the center, to the same place. The elements of truth are the same in all religions, and it makes it a very universal plane. And I think that's what you pick up in Narada's children. It's very much a universal spiritual journey, but from a culture of people of African descent.
To what extent would you say the book is an allegory? In other words, is there a broader message about real-world issues that you want the reader to grasp after or throughout while they're reading the novel?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, Carol. And I try to be brief with this. But first, I think you could say that the story is a myth. A myth not meaning true or false. Myth meaning our worlds are shaped by myths. We live in a Judeo-Christian culture which traces it back to mythology. The same is true with Narada's children. It's a mythical story that kind of undermines in many ways the reality that most people, when they think about what their reality is. Maybe an easy way to say it would be to say it's like building a house that you live in on the top of a volcanic fissure that no longer is dead but can become alive anytime. It undercuts the culture in which we live in today. Is it an allegory? I think it is, because it really says that each person, if we are going to live in a better world, it's a responsibility of each individual to be the best human being they can be in the world. The world will change because people in the world change, not at the community level, but at the individual level, at the family level, which then reflects on the community level, which then reflects on the national level, and that reflects on the world.
Now let's talk about the protagonist, Narada. He says in the book, "I go wherever the great mystery takes me." So without giving away the plot, what are we to make of that particular phrase? And what do you want your readers to take away from his character?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Narada is really a Hindu. 2,000 years ago, the Ramayana was written down by a sage called Valmiki. And the tale of the Ramayana.
And Ramayana, characterize that for us.
The Ramayana is a very ancient Hindu text written about 2,000 years ago. It was actually an oral tradition that ultimately got written down 2,000 years ago. So it's older than 2,000 years. But the story of the Ramayana, which is a story of Rama and Sita, two very important characters, people, personages in Hindu mythology, was told by a person called Narada. So when you see it, for example, at the beginning of the book, there's a quote from the Ramayana that identifies, Valmiki identifies the person that was sitting, that comes to sit next to him as Narada. He knows who he is. But Narada was cursed. Narada was born out of the first thoughts of the divine. But he played a prank on his brother, his brother's two children. And as a result, the divine, whether you want to call it God, Brahma, Allah, cursed him. And his curse was he would wander the universe for the rest of time. So Narada, in many ways, in his travels, his character, his personality really doesn't change. He does impact cultures that he influences, and I find it very interesting. I always found him interesting because he chose communities and people who also felt in some way they were cursed. Not that they necessarily were, but they felt they were.
So are you saying that the people of Jaushu also feel to some extent that they are cursed?
Not as a community, but the characters, the principal characters in the book, have that sense that there's something that they can't seem to overcome. That is a definite challenge for them, which is in some ways a metaphor for life. Life is a challenge. We all have obstacles. We all have strengths and weaknesses, and we must, if we are committed to building the adults we wish to become, we'd like to become, we have to overcome those challenges. People in this book, Narada's children, all feel they have a challenge that is very difficult for them to overcome. Narada helps them work through that.
Is he sort of like a narrative theologian, as you are in your profession? I mean, would you describe him as a narrative theologian?
No, I wouldn't. You know, when I started the novel, I had a key question, and that is if Narada, according to Hindu mythology, was cursed, and his curse was to travel through the rest of the as a wanderer for the rest of time, and Narada's children is a reflection of how he works in the world today, how he works in creation today.
To, in a sense, redeem himself from what he did, to be cursed by wandering around. I mean, what he is doing, influencing others in a positive way, is a way to, in a sense, compensate for his deceptive act when he was younger.
You can say that, but you can also say that he also identifies with the people he comes in contact with, because he understands what their reality is. He understands their way of being in the world, that they have they're handicapped in a way that they can overcome, as he is doing in the way he is in the universe, in existence.
And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Woody Carter. He's author of Narada's Children, A Visionary Tale of Two Cities. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also find a free download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to a Facebook fan, Ndara Mariera from Kisi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the air, please give us some feedback on this show by sending an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And Woody Carter, if our listeners want to order a copy of your book or obtain the book, where could they find it? Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's called sleepingmansbooks.com, sleepingmansbooks.com. But it's also available on amazon.com, both as an e-book as well as print on demand.
All right. Well, before the break, we were talking about other characters in the book, how Narada influences them in Jausu. So I wanted to ask you about other characters. There's a character called Ibrahim Hafez, who's the father of Ohete, who actually first sees Narada in the desert. There's his sister, with whom Narada seems to share a secret. What metaphors do these characters serve as? What would you like the reader to take away from these particular characters?
Well, you know, one principal thing that is a thread throughout the whole book was the focus and emphasis on meditation, on quiet sitting. He introduces each of those characters to the practice of quiet sitting. That is key not only to what happens in Jausu in the 1850s in the Horn of Africa, but it's also that same thread of meditation, of quiet sitting, also comes into play when the story moves to Oakland, California in the year 2003. That issue of quiet sitting, of meditation, is throughout the book. And matter of fact, there's a chapter in the end of the book that really even talks about the physiology of quiet sitting, how the body responds to quiet sitting, and why it is so important for people, especially when you think about relaxing. You ask a person, well, how do you relax? Well, they'll say, I read a book, or I knit, I play golf. They're not really relaxing. Even going to sleep and waking up tired, sleeping necessarily is not really relaxing. You have to be conscious and awake and still to relax. And so I explain in one of the chapters the physiology of quiet sitting. But much of the book is about introducing each of these characters to quiet sitting. Whether they resist it, whether they embrace it, is another matter. But they're all introduced to that by Narada.
Indeed, and I enjoyed that myself about the book. So let's talk about the other city, because it's called A Visionary Tale of Two Cities, and Oakland, California. And in the book, Narada recounts what is called a transcendental tale of a, quote, yet-to-be-born people in a faraway city, which we come to know as Oakland, California, where you have experience as well. You've drawn on your personal and professional experiences in that part of the book as well. Is that part of the reason why you chose Oakland? And what do you see are the parallels between the two cities, Joosu and Oakland?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the parallels that we
The communities learn? In each of those cities has to evolve in some way. And Narada becomes the catalyst for that evolution. In Oakland, California, a very real, in 2003 and probably and still today, was that the African-American community in Oakland and most of California, which is a prototypical of what's happening in most African-American communities throughout the country, health-wise, there's a health crisis. A health crisis that the Alameda County Public Health Department had a press conference to discuss the health crisis and ask the African-American community what they were going to do about this crisis. And it was very clear that information like pamphlets and public service announcements were not going to do very much. The issue had to be, how do you change people's behavior to have better health? We're talking about diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, infant mortality. All of these things were plaguing the African-American community. So to respond to the health crisis, the Bay Area Black United Fund initiated a project called Critical Mass Health Conductors, which brought African-Americans together to meet once a month to address health issues. But they also helped African-Americans form small clusters, 3 to 4 people in a group that would support one another in addressing whatever health issue each individual wanted to do. And after 3 months of going through that project, they graduated. But they also influenced their family and their friends. And with the family influencing their family and friends, we realized that if we could touch, at least so the theory goes, if you can impact 1% of the population, then that 1% can become a catalyst for influencing the rest of the population, because that 1% influence will sustain itself over time. We started out with 30 people. Today, that project is still going on and has influenced the health behavior of over 10,000 people, and it's still going on. So if you go to the Bay Area Black United Fund, BABUF, BABUF.org website, you'll see that the Critical Mass Health Conductors is still going on today.
I was just going to ask you about that. So it's really having a significant impact. It's going on to this day from 2003.
Yes.
Oh, that's really extraordinary. I wanted to know, Woody Carter, about the relationship, if there is one, between Narada in Joosu and Arthur Renfro, who is the protagonist in Oakland, California. Is there a relationship, in your view, between the two?
Well, you know, Narada in 2003 encounters another character called Luther McKenney. Luther McKenney was a real person.
Narada or Arthur?
Luther McKenney.
Okay.
Luther McKenney was a real person. He passed away about 9 years ago. But in the book, Narada becomes Luther McKenney. So that Narada is not only in the old city in Africa in the 1850s, he's also in Oakland in the person of Luther McKenney, who influences the behavior of Arthur, who introduces Arthur to meditation.
Very interesting. Are there any other parallels among characters in Joosu and Oakland, California, that you want to talk about?
I think the parallel is Narada's influence as Luther McKenney's influence in Oakland, California, is not direct but indirect. He's bound not to interfere with human evolution and human interaction in any direct sense, so that Narada, Luther McKenney in Oakland, becomes a catalyst for change. But the change actually must take place by the people themselves. And that happens in both the Horn of Africa in 1850 with the Oromo, who are considered a lower caste in Joosu, who are persecuted. It's true in Oakland, California, as the African Americans have to deal with the issue of prejudice and persecution in a larger Western culture. Matter of fact, I think it would be fair to say that, especially in Oakland, that part of the story that deals with Oakland, the issue of meditation is viewed as a prophylactic against living in a white supremacist culture.
Well, that's a very interesting point. Also, the fact that there are so many parallels, you know, between
Jiaosu and Oakland, particularly where you talk about the discrepancies between the haves and the have-nots in both cities. Oromo, referring to actually the Oromo ethnic group, I assume, in Ethiopia at that time, vis-a-vis other groups. And now, of course, in Oakland, we're referring to African-Americans vis-a-vis the dominant Caucasian culture.
Yes, in both cities, the communities that Narada deals with are communities that have to take responsibility for their own health and well-being because government is not going to be able to do it. People's values and ways of being in the world are shaped by the families they are born into, and any change that takes place has to relate in a direct sense to changing a people's worldview. Every culture, every city, every community has the right and the responsibility to take responsibility for change in their community with help from municipal government entities. But those entities, those institutions cannot make those changes. It's a community that has to take responsibility for their self-help is a prerequisite for both Jiaosu and the Oromo, as well as Oakland's African-American community.
And I'd like now to talk about, you know, your work as a narrative theologian. You have an amazing background from the time you spent, of course, in the Peace Corps to throughout your career. What prompted you to take up this profession, and how would you describe the role of a narrative theologian in contemporary culture?
Well, that's a big question. It's a good question, too. I've wrestled with that since writing the book. I've gotten great positive feedback from the book. If anyone went on Amazon.com, you'll see that there's probably about 11 reviews. All of them are one four-star, 10 of them are five-star. So I know that the book is viewed very positively, but how to apply the work in the book has been a challenge of mine. I recently developed a two-day workshop specifically to using both story and meditation as a way to introduce story in a culturally specific way to people of African descent. Story, because I think that when you think about it, we all live in story. We cannot get out of story. When we look at our lives, we look at it through story, through a narrative. And so understanding, for example, the stories of our ancestors, of those people who come before, even our immediate parents, and what they have left with us, the stories they hold, the good, the bad, and the ugly, are very important to us, especially those of us who have trauma and traumatic experiences, to understand the reality of what your parents have passed on to you, because in understanding that, then you begin to think about how might you change that if you wish to, and meditation becomes a tool for doing that. For example, in my own family, there's a great deal of addictive behavior, so that my grandfather, my father, my brothers, all past had instances of addiction, whether it was alcohol to drugs. I thought I escaped that because I don't drink, and I used to smoke a lot of marijuana, but I don't anymore for the past 20 years. But I realized I still had addictive behavior, and that addictive behavior, when I realized that that's what part of that impulse of addiction got passed on to me, and that I couldn't change it, I couldn't get rid of that intellectually, what I discovered was that in time, the practice of meditation helped me deal with that to the point that I no longer felt I needed to have that kind of pacification in order to deal with life.
One quick question with respect to the relationship between organized religion, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, Islam, in terms of the Abrahamic religions or other Eastern religions. What is the relationship between organized religion and your work as a narrative theologian? Is there a connection or a disconnect?
I try not to deal with organized religion. If you define organized religion as the study of a people's convictions and belief system, that's what theology is about. That's what religion is about, a community of people that have common convictions, things that are belief systems that are so deep that if you took them away from that people, they would no longer be that. I don't deal with that. What I'm dealing with is a more universal issue of spirituality. Spirituality defined as that, in my thinking, is the integration of mind, body, and spirit, becoming whole as a human being, how do we integrate all those impulses within us, our physical well-being, our spiritual well-being, our sense of being in the world? We all are evolving, whether we're going forward in life or whether we're moving backward in life. We all are moving in some way. And that evolution, that practice of being more intentful about how I evolve is spirituality.
So basically what I take away is that there is no contradiction between being a narrative theologian and maybe being associated with one of these organized religions. They could be complementary.
Sure.
I want to take you back to the book in terms of its style, Woody Carter. I noticed very interestingly that in terms of some of the sentence structure, particularly related to the East African city of Jaousu, one could say, were you influenced by Star Wars in any way, in particular the character Yoda, in terms of the sentence structure?
No, not at all. It was very clear to me in having to create, to develop two different worlds in the book. I had to find a way to distinguish one world from the other. And even though the book is in English, the way people speak in Jaousu on the Horn of Africa is very different than the way people speak in Oakland, California. So I use the structure of Amharic, which is a national language of Ethiopia. There are about 100 languages in Ethiopia, by the way. But at the time when I was there, Amharic was the national language. Most people spoke Amharic and their indigenous language. But the English in the book is actual a translation of Amharic, the structure of language in Amharic in the book. And you'll find that in Amharic, the verbs come first, and then the subject, the noun, comes last. So instead of we would say, I'm going to the store, that would be akin to the way people would say it in Oakland, California. In Jaousu, they would say, to the store, I'm going.
Well, as we close, what is the biggest takeaway you hope your readers will glean from this novel?
Two things. One is the importance, the value of finding time in their lives for quiet sitting, whether you want to call it meditation, quiet sitting, sitting quietly, it does not matter. But like we take a shower every day or take the shower, on a regular basis, we need to take a shower of our mind. Our mind needs to be showered, have a shower, especially living in a toxic environment or dealing with the challenges in our life. That's one thing, meditation. Secondly, the idea that the reality that we're so sure about our existence, about the way we exist, but we're all changing. Nothing remains the same. People come and go. People come into the world. They're born. They go through childhood. They become adults. They grow old and they pass away. That's what life is about. We could not have life without death. But in spite of the fact that we have to always live with that reality of the fact that we will all pass away in time, we are evolving spirits. We are all spirits that are evolving. And that what we think are so permanent in life, with job, family, people, in order to address, to understand Narada's children, gives us that reminder that, no, we're all just passing through.
And the book is Narada's Children, A Visionary Tale of Two Cities, the author, writer, and narrative theologian, Woody Carter. Well, Woody Carter, thank you so much for coming in, talking about your novel, and sharing so many other interesting stories with us.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. I'm really surprised the depth of your interview. I really appreciate your questions. Very thought-provoking way of interviewing. I had no idea that the interview would be so extensive and so thoughtful, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Your book deserves nothing less. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.